The Good Neighbor Network. FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro. FM 100.5 Smyrna. And online at WGNSradio.com.
What is up? Welcome on the show, giving you the truth about personal finance. This is Financial Coaching Radio, and I'm your host, Jason Qualls, certified financial planner, one of the only independent commission-free financial advisors in Murphy County. Jason Qualls, CFP.com, J-A-S-O-N-Q-U-A-L-L-S, CFP.com. If you want to jump in and be a part of the show, click email the show or any of the social media links at financialcoachingradio.com. A topic we have not discussed in quite some time, an overlooked vital part of estate planning, and a very inexpensive problem to solve, and that is liability insurance or umbrella insurance. No one likes to talk about insurance, but this is one of these easy ones. Umbrella insurance usually refers to a policy that kicks in after the liability limits of your auto insurance or your renter's insurance, in some cases, home insurance, liability limits are exhausted. It's over and above that. So if you had $250,000 of liability limits on your auto, but you were in an accident where you were sued for, you know, $500,000, that if you had an umbrella policy, it would cover the difference between the capped out limit on your auto in between the lawsuit. So the big question would be is how much do you need? And it all depends on net worth. And one of the things that always kind of makes me think is like, well, the more liability insurance you have, the more likely you are to be suable because you actually have something they can go get. But I'd like to look at it. Well, if you have $1 million net worth, we need at least $1 million or more of liability insurance. To get the maximum amount of umbrella insurance, you got to typically have $250,000, $500,000, $500,000 of liability limits on your car insurance. Typically somewhere similar to that liability on your homeowner's insurance. They all work together. Because again, this umbrella or liability coverage over and above those limits is where this kicks in. And it's gotten more expensive over the years. But we're talking about around $300 per year for about $1 million. And of course, it's going to be different for everyone, different situations. And it's going to cover a lot of vast things. But you're looking, going to get, most people are going to need that have some financial assets. They own their own home. They're investing in retirement plans. They're not crushing it. They're not multimillionaires, but they got stuff going on. They're on track for retirement at age 55, 60, 65. They need an umbrella policy. They need that $1 to $2 million of protection, and looking at Kiplinger right now, which is a personal finance magazine, they're doing just what I was describing in their umbrella insurance calculator. That you put in your net worth, put in your home equity, put in the value of your retirement plans, and it gives you a calculation. So let's say your net worth is $250,000, home equity, which depends on where you live. And when you bought your house, could be significant. We'll just say $100,000. Maybe you got another $250,000 in retirement plans. You have a limit on your current coverage, let's say $250,000. Just what I was describing, right? And it tells us what we need for umbrella coverage. Well, in that scenario, maybe it's not enough. We need more. But millions about the starting mark. I don't know if you can even get umbrella insurance, less than $1 million. Your insurance agents could weigh in on this on social media. I've never seen an umbrella policy less than $1 million. If you're going to go over $3 million, certainly over $5 million, you're going to have to get some special coverage. But where does all this kick in? Where does all this recommendation come from? I'll make it really, really simple for you. It doesn't really technically come from your insurance agent. If your insurance agent hasn't talked to you about this, and a financial planning perspective, probably don't have a great agent. But this is going to come from your certified financial planner having conversations about those limits, about your net worth. Risk management is a key piece of financial planning. It all has to work together. It's not all about the fun stuff, investing and then retirement. All right, I'm Jason Qual, certified financial planner. Going to switch gears for just a second, talk about CDs or bonds, which is better. And I don't even like that question. Of course, you want whatever's paying the highest interest rate, right? But what are we talking about? Is a CD or a bond owned individually? CDs have guarantees. Corporate bonds do not. Government bonds somewhat do, but the taxing power of the U.S. government. But it can't just be a pure interest rate discussion, because if I throw you out two options, I'm going to give you a 4% bond or a 5% CD. Both are 1 year. Some of those still exist. It'd be close to find that today. You're going to say, well, I'll take the 5%, of course. Why wouldn't I? Well, we got to look at the tax perspective. Is it going into an IRA or going to own it individually? Because if it's going into an IRA, it's in a tax-deferred account, and you know, taxable interest doesn't matter. But if we're looking at a taxable account, looking at a CD that has taxable interest versus maybe a tax-free municipal bond, we got to compare the tax equivalent yield of that. So if you got a 4.5% tax-free bond, typically that's going to be worth more than a 5% CD in the taxable world. So that's why the question that's posed, which is better, is kind of a loaded question, right? And this is what the purpose of financial articles is. Get us to read, get us to click, get us to learn, get us to think about these things. Here's the bottom line. You know, I think using CDs and building CD ladders or individual bonds and building bond ladders to create sustainable income with very little or lowering this interest rate risk as much as possible is a very valuable thing. But I also like not paying taxes. And the more interest that we have that is taxable, the more the government's going to take from us because of our tax rate. But the more we have that is tax-free through municipal bond interest, those things have to be a concern in this arena. And in some circles, circle would not be the right terminology, but in certain facets, you look at the rate of return of municipal bonds, they've done significantly better in some cases than just your typical fixed rate assets like CDs. Even today, it's kind of one of those things like what is going on? We have money market accounts these days paying 4.5%. And that's money that you can get into anytime, anywhere. That's really in today's environment. It depends on when you may be listening to the show on a podcast in the future. That's just where we're at right now. I don't see a whole lot of advantage to locking money up into CDs or even corporate bonds or government bonds in that sense because money market rates are so significantly high. Now, will that be the case 6 months from now? Will that be the case, a year from now? Who knows? But that is certainly where it stands today if we're just trying to maximize interest. But then we also have to take into the account 4.5%, 4.25% on a money market account that's taxable in the individual taxable investment account versus maybe 3.75 or 4% on a municipal bond that's tax-free. Got to know those things. Got to have that discussion. Asset location is just as important as asset allocation. If you don't know what I'm talking about there, make sure you get a second opinion on your investments, your financial plan, your financial life from an independent fee-only certified financial planner, Jason Qualls, CFP.com for Mo. All right, I'm back at you after this. John Baker, estate planning attorney, will be joining in. We'll discuss that and more. See you then.
Hey, Financial Coaching Radio listeners, if you don't understand exactly how your financial advisor is compensated, you could be in big trouble. My name is Jason Qualls, a commission-free certified financial planner. To learn more about why my process is so unique, go to jasonquallscfp.com or call 878 878- 2134 today. Okay, folks, I've said it before, but I'm going to say it again. If you were my client or a loved one, I would never let you get your wills done online. This is truly a case of where you only get what you pay for, and those you leave behind will be the ones to pay the price. Go see estate planning attorney John Baker today by calling 896-5621 or go to bakercounsel.com. Again, that's 896-5621 or bakercounsel.com. Get the expert estate planning advice you need today.
Did you know that the U.S. tax code has over 70,000 pages? This is precisely why you must have a tax expert on your team. The folks at THW CPAs have been providing their expertise to individuals and businesses in Middle Tennessee for over 50 years. And now they have an office right here in Murfreesboro. Call Kevin Sizemore today with THW CPAs at 848-1072. That's 848-1072 or online at thwcpa.com.
Welcome back to the show. This is Financial Coaching Radio, financialcoachingradio.com. To listen to the show anytime, anywhere, I'm Jason Qualls, Certified Financial Planner, talking estate planning and much, much more with John Baker, estate planning attorney. Welcome back to the show, John.
Well, thanks, Jason. Always great to be here.
All right. So let me ask you a question. A lot of people, as they get up in age, want to add their children to their bank accounts, financial accounts. And I guess it's an estate planning tactic, right?
That's
right. Or maybe even open an account for your child and your name's on there. What are some of the pitfalls that you can run into by doing that? Is that something that is suggested, or is it depends on what your circumstances are?
Yeah, you know, obviously the advantage is just the ease and convenience. You know, there's no legal documents. You just go to the bank and update your account. But there are some risks and pitfalls. If you put someone on the account, you know, as a joint account holder, and then that person has some sort of legal liability, you know, that could expose your funds that are in the account. Of course, the person on the account has full access to the account just as you would. And
is there any restrictions there? Or is it just?
I mean, not really. I mean, there.
So, say in, mom, she's up in age. She has on a bank account, checking account, or savings account, or whatever. And she just adds you to the account. You have full authority on that account.
That's right. You could take the money out. Now, that doesn't mean mama couldn't sue you. Okay, but the bank's not in trouble. I mean, she's on the account, so the bank is probably fine. But and then that leaves mama having to sue, you know, whoever, her son or daughter that was on the account. But I think the concern that I'm, you know, most cases I'm dealing with, you know, we have good children, good families, and you know, they're probably not going to do that sort of thing. But the concern for me is not that they would do something, you know, to commit some kind of, you know, fraud or
well, they don't
or scheme.
Know, steal their parents,
right? I mean,
they're just putting them on there because
we'll presume we have some good children here that are just trying to help mom or dad, and it can be a very helpful thing, and it's very common to do. But I suggest doing it with smaller accounts, like their operating account, where mom or dad's pension is going in, or their Social Security, and you know, where they're paying their bills. And then don't keep a lot of money in that account. You know, it's an operating account. Keep enough to operate and pay your monthly bills. And that way, you know, if you need help, your child's on the account. For your larger accounts that are more your savings and your investments, you know, I don't recommend joint accounts because of those risks. There are better ways to do that.
And is it a gift? When you do that, when you add someone to your account?
Not at that moment. It's not a gift until they take money out, you know, for themselves.
So just for themselves.
Right. Yeah, I had a whole lawsuit on that one time. So went up to the Court of Appeals, if you can believe that.
Well, I'm really surprised because there's a lot of things that IRS calls a gift.
That's right.
I would think that would be one of them.
Because it's not complete. You're on the account, but you haven't taken dominion and control of the funds. You don't do that till you pull them out. And then the gift has occurred.
So,
or the, you know, taking, whatever.
Your elderly parent adds you to their bank account or other accounts. And then you were to get sued, get in a car accident or whatever, mm-hmm. go through a divorce. Those assets are exposed. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And a lot of times the way I'll describe it, I may tell mom or dad, now it was your money in the account, and you may be able to hire a lawyer and go spend thousands of dollars and protect the funds that were in there. But we don't want to do that. And you might lose, too. So... You know, it's best not to use, in my opinion, large accounts like your investments and your savings joint like that. There are better ways to do it. You could add a child as an agent under power of attorney where they're not legal owners or account holders.
Yeah, why wouldn't you just do, if yeah. let's say the child is already a power of attorney, what mm-hmm. is the advantage of adding them yeah. to the account?
Well, I think, you know, like when you go down to the bank, you know, to set that up, the advantage of the joint account holders, if mom or dad dies, the child has immediate access to the account. Whereas if it's a power of attorney account,
the probate will come in.
It ends. And so, of course, you could do a pay-on-death designation on a lot of accounts to avoid that as well. So there are a lot of ways to avoid that. You can use a trust to avoid that, trustee relations. So there's a lot of ways to avoid that when you're talking about
So it's just about passing the asset down at death, mm-hmm. payable on death, mm-hmm. transfer on death would yes. be a way to – you don't yeah. have to add them to the account.
That's right. And some bank accounts don't have that feature, but a lot do now. I see a lot of people come in even with their regular bank accounts.
And when you're doing it with a bank account, are you changing the account title? Is it going from a single individual account to a joint account?
Yeah, basically, yes.
Just like you would do in the investment world.
Yes, yeah, very, it'd be very similar.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking estate planning and much more with John Baker, estate planning attorney, BakerCounsel.com, BakerCounsel.com. What about minors? You know, you're a parent, you're opening an account for your child. I don't even know the rules and regulations. They have to be a certain age before they can have an account in their name. I would assume it would be 16, but I'm not sure. Do they have to be adults?
Yeah, so the... just for my own children, when they were, you know, under 18, you know, in high school, and they want a bank account, and it was pretty easy to set up. And on that account, you know, at least, you know, when we did it, you know, the parent is on the account as well. And and it may be set up, I'm not sure, and I'm talking about like a checking account, so the child can have a debit card and can, you know, buy things and pay for
gas, buy food.
That's right. And so we were actually on that account with the child, but I'm not sure what the structure of that was. Now, there are what we call the custodial accounts, which
are that's a whole different deal. Yeah.
And that's where the parent or some other responsible adult is the holder of the account, but the funds in it actually belong to the child, but the child doesn't have the ability to pull money out themselves and use it like it would a bank account.
Now, I can't imagine, maybe it's so, that those ones for children are custodial accounts, but I don't know if they would be, right?
Yeah, because I'm not sure what the structure is on that, but we had equal access. My son could use a card, I could use a card, and maybe they're doing it. They structure it where they're doing it under the authority of the parent, you know, and the child is somehow able to do that. But
any legal ramifications there as it relates? We're talking about. No, elderly parents mm-hmm. putting their children, adult children, on their accounts for estate planning tactics and strategies. Right. What about as a liability risk when you're doing it for a minor?
Yeah, I suppose you could have similar types of concerns. However, you know, probably in that minor account, you know, I mean, there's probably not going to be a lot of money. And if the child is starting to accumulate money, then they probably need to do something a little more substance to it other than, you know, just an easy high school student account. I think they call them student accounts. But if it is a joint account arrangement, you know, you could have the same issues there. But again, most of the time, the money in there is not going to be large amount.
In the estate planning world for, you know, lowering inheritance taxes or making or custodial account, I guess tax shifting is really what the main objective of a custodial account would be. Are those still things that are being commonly used? I don't use them as much because most of the time when parents are wanting to accumulate money for their child, if they're working, they're thinking Roth IRA. If they're not working, they're thinking college savings or 529 plans. But back in the day, 10, 15 years ago, custodial accounts were just kind of the thing.
The thing, yeah. I tell you where I typically will see it sometimes is where the minor has inherited some monies from, let's say, you know, grandmother gave the child $5,000, and the court, and it's in a probate, and the court has discretion to authorize a custodial account. And so in that situation, the court you know, there might be an order that says the child's funds shall be placed in a custodial account. But you're right, I don't think I see it as much either when it's just the parent wanting to set up some sort of fund for the child while everybody's alive and well.
And the hitch up to those is that, what, I guess at 21, it becomes their money.
That's right. Yeah, I think, you know,
it's an investment account or just a bank account. Right. You know, your total control goes away when they, I guess, age of majority.
Right. So, and like you said, I think the investment type accounts, like a 529, a Roth, IRA, or, you know, some other probably more financially attractive type of account than the custodial.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking estate planning. I'm Jason Qualls, certified financial planner. In the studio is John Baker, estate planning attorney. Make sure you stick around. There's more right after this.
Have a financial plan? I'm not talking about a worthless binder full of pretty charts and graphs. Are you certain you're on track to reach all your financial goals? A comprehensive financial plan is about so much more than just your IRA and mutual funds. It involves risk management, tax planning, professional investment management, retirement, and estate planning. Make sure your entire financial life is in order by calling me, Jason Qualls, a commission-free certified financial planner at 878-2134. Or go to my website, jasonquallscfp.com. Buying a house is stressful, and so is shopping for a mortgage. Take my advice and get a second opinion on the mortgage for your new home or your refinance. Not all banks and mortgage companies are created equal. Trust me on this. Call my friend Marshall Sparkman with Franklin Synergy Bank at 615-439-0885. Great team, great process, and the best rates. Marshall Sparkman with Franklin Synergy Bank at 615-439-0885.
Welcome back to the show. This is Financial Coaching Radio. I'm Jason Qualls, certified financial planner. Jason Qualls, CFP.com for all about me. John Baker, estate planning attorney, is still here. John, let's continue on talking about children and estate planning. We've referenced it many times that when your child becomes 18, getting powers of attorney. But there's also other areas that get overlooked by young parents, and that is making sure their documents properly address how to care for their minor children. Because in my view, that is one of the key things of basic estate planning, is who's going to care for and provide for your minor children, whether that could be someone who has disabilities, which even gets more strategic in those areas. But, you know, basic estate planning documents, people feel like it's all about, well, where does my stuff go when I pass away? Well, that's true, but when you have a minor child, and there's a lot of single parents out there, who's supposed to care for them? How does it work? Because I can imagine a lot, you know, just in because it is a freak thing that if a young parent passes away, it's not that common, but it does happen. How does the court system deal with that when someone does not have a will that named a guardian for their children?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think you're at, you know, absolutely.
Does it always go to the other parent? Does it go to the grandparent? What is it?
Yeah,
what happens?
So the presumption, you know, where is that the guardian will be the surviving parent. And if there's
is that ever an issue where they, like, maybe the surviving parent wasn't
if they're not
involved
fit
very much?
Yeah, if they're not fit to be that. But that surviving parent is going to certainly have priority and rights to parent the child unless they're proven, you know, in court to be unfit to do so.
And who makes those claims?
And so the grandparents, other relatives that
maybe
want
custody
to care for the child, and then of course, you know, it gets in front of the court and the judge ultimately decides the issue. And
I could see that going a lot of different ways.
Yeah, that's a horrible situation to find yourself in if that happens.
Is that an estate planning matter or is it more of a family court?
Well, I think whatever court has jurisdiction, you know, in the local community will address that, you know, in Tennessee That might be the probate court. In some situations, it could even be the juvenile court or the chancery court. So, but whatever court you're in, you know, the judge is going to sort all that out and make the determination. But what you can do is just as part of good planning, and kind of like what you were saying, you know, how that's just a should be a basic component of your estate planning to name a guardian.
As soon as you have children, life insurance, get in a basic will that names a guardian.
Right. You know, sometimes, you know, myself and, you know, us professional planners get caught up in some of the financial, the asset protection, some of these bigger issues. But for a parent with minor children, is there really anything bigger than selecting the guardian and stating in a legal document who you want that guardian to be if you and the other parent can't do it? Because, you know, that's probably your number one concern. And it sounds so basic, and it is. But sometimes, you know, we don't really think that through, and we don't nominate someone. But if you nominate someone in, let's say, your will, the court will have to give weight to that, you know, when the judge makes
the
decision.
So you're a single parent, and you say, well, I just want my guardian of my children to be my mother. But mm-hmm. there's a surviving parent out there.
Well, you got two sets of grandparents.
Perhaps. Right. So who I named will get some type of weight, even though it's not the other parent?
Yes. No. If there's a surviving parent, that surviving parent's going to have priority unless there's something wrong with the ability of that parent to care for the child. But if there's no surviving parent, and let's say we got two sets of grandparents, they both want custody. If the parent or parents have named one set of grandparents to be the guardian, then that's probably who the court is going to appoint, assuming they're able and capable of doing it.
Right.
Those can be.
So when does it become a legal issue with the surviving parent and then maybe someone else that want? Is it just because someone contests it?
Basically. That's right. Someone would.
Sounds like that would get expensive.
Yes. It's like, I mean. In the realm
you
of.
You both have to prove your case, and that's going to take some time.
Most people don't want to be in any lawsuit, and maybe the hierarchy that you don't want to. You know, nobody wants to be in a divorce case if they can avoid it. And probably fighting over parental custody or guardianship is right behind that. You know, it's because it's so emotional and it's got family issues. It's just a very stressful thing to go through if there's a dispute about that.
So make sure you have a will that names a guardian for your minor children. And that's guardian of, you know, their care. Yep. But you also can name a separate guardian, which is, you know, for the money.
That's right.
And through a trust or just straight up guardianship.
And if it's a guardianship, you know, you nominate the person in your will, and then the court gives preference to that person. And ultimately, the court appoints the person. But the court will give preference to who you've nominated in your legal document.
Where did this – I don't ask you a law history question, if you may know this or not. Where did all this come into play? You know, we have these legal documents that are wills, powers of attorney, and then as soon as something happens, especially on at death, the court steps in and kind of validates this. When did that start happening as part of the process? Do you know? Has it always been that way, or did it, when they originally were created – whatever the document said is kind of what the statement.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, let's say in the case of a will, and you know, it's always been the case that, you know, to give that will legal effect, it must go through the probate court. And that court then has jurisdiction over the issues that are pertinent to that will. And one of those issues could be appointing the guardian of the minor child. So that, yeah, that has been around, you know, forever. And it's... so it's nothing new. It's always been like that, and that's just basically what is going to happen if there's not a surviving parent. Now, if there's a surviving parent, the parent will, and let's assume the parent is fit and there's no issues there. The parent will have physical custody and make all those types of decisions for the child. You know, education, health, and all of those things. But if the child also is getting money, you know, let's say from a deceased parent, even the surviving parent cannot control that money without the court guardianship, you know, unless it was in a trust or some other
So of course, you want to name that. So
it's not unusual to have a surviving parent have to go get a guardianship over the money that the child is inheriting from the deceased parent until that child's 18. So
all stuff you got to make sure you plan for. Reach out to John Baker, estate planning attorney, BakerCouncil.com. BakerCouncil.com. John, I appreciate your time.
All right. Always great to be here, Jason. Thanks.
This is Financial Coaching Radio. Keep it locked in for more local talk and always Financial Coaching Radio every day, every weekday, right here on WGNS. Back right after this.
How much are your investments costing you each year? Most people don't have a clue. Why is this extremely important? Because overpaying by just 1% a year in fees and expenses can reduce your account balance at retirement by 28%. You heard me right. 28% less at retirement. I'm commission-free, certified financial planner Jason Qualls. I don't sell financial products. I don't accept commissions or kickbacks from investment companies. Give me a call today for a free unbiased investment review at 878-2134 or visit my website, jasonquallscfp.com. A recent undercover study found that over 89% of paid tax preparers made mistakes. You heard me right, over 89%. Is your tax person making mistakes? Tax mistakes cost you money and may even lead to an IRS audit. I recommend you get a second opinion on your tax return today by calling Tuthero Helen Welch CPAs at 848-1072. Tuthero Helen Welch has been providing tax services to individuals and businesses for over 50 years. So call them today at 848-1072 or go to thwcpa.com. Welcome back as we get prepared to close out the show. This is Financial Coaching Radio. Reminder, again, you can listen to the show anytime, anywhere at financialcoachingradio.com. Click on archives, most recent shows. Get all the links there on the website, financialcoachingradio.com. Click archives. If you're looking to learn more about what I do, how I do it, what makes independent fee-only certified financial planners unique, and unique from a typical financial salesperson, because most financial people, I don't care how long they've been in business, but most of them are on some level, they're salespeople. They're working some level on commission, they're gathering accounts, and that's what they care more about. They care less about doing what's in your best interest, and that's the whole point of independent fee-only CFP. If you want to jump on to jasonquallscfp.com, you can learn more all about that. And much, much more. Because, you know, get a second opinion from an independent fee-only CFP is the way to go. All right, I'm out of here for today. I appreciate you listening today and every day. WGNS is your place in Rutherford County for local talk, be financial talk, be sports, local sports, MTSU. You got it all here. Keep it locked in right here on WGNS. I'll see you tomorrow, same time, same channel. Back at you then.